Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in General History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts on the channel, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very intrigued today to be interviewing Dr. Sophia Stock about her book titled The Opening Statement of the Prosecution in International Criminal Trials, A Solemn Tale of Horror, published in 2021 by Routledge. The book addresses the importance of the prosecution's opening statement before an international criminal tribunal. And this is really interesting because opening statements are not really legally worth anything. They're not officially part of what counts in a legal sense, but they're also kind of the first big statement when an international criminal trial starts. And international criminal trials, by definition, are events and dealing with circumstances that are seen as kind of too big and too bad to be dealt with in any other kind of court. So opening statements live in this really interesting place of like not really having legal weight, but still having a huge impact because of who they're in front of and when they are given. And so I learned loads from this book personally about a thing that maybe many of us have kind of come across, an opening statement. Yeah, of course there's an opening statement. It has to start somehow, right? But maybe never really thought about. So thankfully, Dr. Sophia Stock has thought about it for us, and I'm thrilled to welcome her to the podcast so we can learn from her.
Thank you.
So I'm wondering if we could start off, please, by asking you to kind of introduce yourself a bit, your academic background, and explain how you came to write this book.
Well, thank you, first of all, for the lovely invitation to talk about this book and the wonderful introduction. It's exactly that, huh? The opening statements. It sounds so familiar, but it's full of surprises, I discovered. So I'm Sophia Stock. I work at the Osser Institute in The Hague, part of the University of Amsterdam. And there I now focus more on the visualization of international law. So I'm always attracted by these borderline, is it law, is it not law, but it matters to law, such as dramatic discourses in the opening statement or visualizations of law right now. And my academic background, so I have a bit of a mixed background. Once upon a time, I studied linguistics. I did conflict studies and human rights as a master's and then my PhD in international criminal law, and that's also where I worked on opening statements. So it started off as a project in the theatrical or international criminal trials as theatrical performances. And when I started working on that, the opening statements was one of the things that stood out. And then in the end, I wrote a whole dissertation and then a whole book about it.
That makes a lot of sense to hear that you have linguistics somewhere in your background to combine then with international law and bring this kind of different perspective into it. So I'd love to kind of start off at the beginning, both of opening statements and, of course, of the book. And you talk about how opening statements are both, quote, crucial and irrelevant, which is a great pairing. And kind of I mentioned that already in the introduction. So can you tell us kind of a bit more about sort of these two halves?
Yes. Well, like you said, it's this very interesting space in which the opening statement is both a momentous occasion, the beginning of a trial, the moment in which you set the stage. And at the same time, it is also merely the introduction of the trial. And it's also treated as such. So it is part of the proceedings, but it's not regarded as anything that brings any arguments. It's just a summary of the arguments or introduction of the evidence, but not the real thing. That said, it's also hardly ever omitted, although it's usually not mandatory, but it is really taken up as an occasion to start. And I think especially in international contexts, where you see that legitimacy is an issue for all tribunals and courts in an international sphere, that this moment where there's actually an audience, it's a crucial moment for not only starting the case, but also reaffirming, justifying the relevance of the trial and the tribunal, and maybe even ICL as an international criminal law as a whole. So you see all these things coming together in this explosive moment of beginning, which I think is really, it's really a wonderful tension that brings about a very unique storytelling moment. And indeed, it's also a moment that's picked up by the media and trials. I mean, they take a long time, especially in international criminal law. It can take years and years, and nothing really is covered by the media. Just a few maybe curious academics who work on these specific issues or lawyers, but not so much the broader public. And the opening statement is one of these moments, I think, together with the closing statement and the judgment, is one of these moments that actually reach a broad audience. So in that sense, it's also important, yet irrelevant, because technically speaking, it's not doing anything for the trial, but summarizing it.
Yeah, the media aspect becomes particularly interesting when you do think of it, as you just said, the context of its years. And kind of having this to kind of go back to or understand what's happening is really important. But you also talk about the importance of kind of setting the stage, as it were, not just from a media perspective from the public, but also serving kind of a, I guess, an institutional purpose, a sort of justification of why this is happening. So I was wondering if you could sort of talk us through those mechanisms where the opening statement kind of is a way to justify and legitimize kind of what the court is then about to do.
Yeah, and I think it's a legitimizing, a self-legitimizing narrative that again addresses different audiences. So it's both the internal community of lawyers, the people present in the courtroom, as well as again the bigger audience. And what I found striking in the opening statements that I've studied, that there is always an appeal to history. And clearly that's the history of the case. There is a lot of literature on trials, as also writing historical records, etc. But what I'm interested in is the history that prosecutors tell about the trial and the tribunal itself. And then again, I'm coming to this point of the legitimacy crisis of international criminal law that is, I think, is a permanent status. But you see that every prosecutor at every tribunal or court takes this opportunity to say something about both the novelty of this very trial tribunal, this very case, as well as affirming that it's a well-established tradition in which they're working, and that this case has a history. And you see that these elements together, they provide a discourse that describes the trial or the tribunal as a turning point in time, from violence to a better future. And that means both explaining that it's a groundbreaking development, but also affirming its pre-existence. So the trial is described as some sort of logical outcome of history, as well as a break with the past. And you see this tension coming up in different times, at different occasions. So at the International Military Tribunal, where Justice Jackson did his famous opening statement, you see it feels very urgent to describe that this is not something that came out of nowhere, and that there is a history, but there's not an established history of international criminal law then. So he picks bits and pieces from the history of law and the international developments to say, okay, look, we're here doing something that's not entirely something that we just figured out. It has a rich tradition. At the same time, we're really making groundbreaking steps also in this context because of the war. And it was something that was also unprecedented. And you see this argument. And then if we go like many, many years later, for example, to the special court for Sierra Leone, you see how the prosecutors there also cite Jackson in their own statement. So they bring this history really into the tribunal. And they do a similar thing. So they say, okay, what we do here now is we have to do this groundbreaking trial. So again, it's something groundbreaking to deal with a violent past and to bring a better future. But we do this standing on the shoulders of others. So it is a rich tradition. And I think this dynamic is really something that reoccurs all the time, even at the International Criminal Court, which is supposed to be a permanent court. So maybe there's less need to refer to history all the time.
If there's less need, though, then why do they keep doing it?
Yeah, well, because I think the question of legitimacy remains a pertinent one. And I think history in that sense and time and to show your embeddedness in this history, and also the things that you bring and this narrative of progress, it's a method to tackle this these questions of legitimacy in such a self-justifying narrative.
That makes sense. So we've been discussing.
I'm glad we are done.
Well, we've been discussing then opening statements kind of with the sort of assumption that it's all words, that it's someone's written something down and then they stand up and they say it out loud. And obviously, to a degree, that is true. But something that I found really interesting was how big a deal you show that it is in your book, the use of maps are in opening statements. I didn't even know that that was going to be a part of your book when I selected it. It would have definitely made me choose it. I'm a massive map nerd. So to find out that these things involve maps made it even more interesting. But I was really interested in both how frequently maps are used, how many maps seem to be used. It's not just one. And also that they're used to really tell a story. They're not just kind of like a picture on a screen. And you talk about this, that this is very intentional. And a lot of the time, some of the work that is trying to be done with this is kind of adjusting for the fact that there are a lot of different audiences, right? There are the judges who are actually there in the chamber who are probably not from the place where the conflict that's being discussed took place. But there's also people who were actively involved in the conflict on both sides of the trial who are there. And then there's the international audience of generally interested people. And there's the audience of people who are impacted but might still be there. They're not necessarily directly enough impacted to be physically in the courtroom. So there's all of these different audiences. And you talk about how the opening statement can use maps to kind of address these differences, but that sometimes the attempts to address it make it even more confused or show tensions. So I'm wondering if you can kind of tell us about sort of what's the point of using maps? Like, what are they trying to do? And how does this sort of work and not work?
Yeah, so I studied maps specifically in the context of the International Criminal Court, although they're used elsewhere as well, but I cannot say anything well studied about that. But there you see that indeed, and there is always, especially at the International Criminal Court, this anxiety of being far removed from the situations over which they try to say something. So that's a tension that is always there. And it's a bigger discussion, of course, on local justice. But this anxiety is there at the ICC specifically. And maps, of course, are this sort of, they carry a sort of promise of facts about geography, a sort of neutral device to show, okay, this is the place we're talking about. And I mean, yeah, I think many of us are map nerds. So I think that is also very appealing. But what struck me when I saw the maps, when I was sitting in the public gallery and they showed a map, and I was like, at first I thought, oh yeah, map, that's always good. And then I was like, oh, but I don't really understand what I'm seeing. I don't know where this is. I don't know what it exactly represents. And then it was used in a way that on the map, they projected arrows in two colors, and the colors represented two parties of the conflict, the perpetrators and the victims. And it was such a simplification of the story, and it got me thinking, so this map is part of the argument. And in critical geography, that's also a really big thing, critical cartography as well. And you have this sort of cartographic paradox, which I really like. So a map has to be simplified to work. Otherwise, why would you have a map if in all detail we cannot put all the details on it? But that also means that a map is always a product of choices. So people make a map and select the elements that are on the map or not. And then in the context of the court, maps are used in the context of a certain story. And so again, the map is explained by someone in a very particular way. So maps are specific techniques of making truth, a specific technique of knowledge production. And when the maps, and I study them in the story about the local, and the local in international criminal trials, that's not an absolute external reality. And also the way in which the local is made sense of is indeed appealing to different audiences. And in words, it's a lot of times you can hear referring to, okay, this trial is also for our local audiences. But these maps and the way in which they explain are explained clearly targets an audience that's not familiar with the place. And in the book, I describe how maps are used to order and imagine, but also appropriate the local to make it in a place that fits with the narrative of the prosecution. So it's a simplification, and it's making a binary story. At the same time, what struck me is that that's not enough. So maps are in these stories always accompanied by more poetic stories and an appeal to imagination by, for example, landscape descriptions. Again, directed to an audience that's clearly not local. And this is also appropriated into the legal narrative. And this contrast between the peaceful landscape and the violence also is doing something that is a bit problematic, in the sense that it's also sort of estrangement and this orientalistic sort of descriptions of the exotic beauty, which is, when you think about a broader discussion on, for example, the ICC's African bias, it's a really tricky thing. And the assumption that maps are just neutral representations of spaces and places is that's untenable. You cannot say that, but it's interesting to have a deeper look at what these maps then do in the story and how they support this binary narrative and how they also support this legitimizing look, we know the local. We may be far away, but we are very familiar with the place where this all happened.
And this is even more complicated in a way, in addition to the complexities of maps generally, and the kind of decisions they have to make and how you then translate that into explaining a war, by the fact that, again, as we've already mentioned, the opening statement is not legally part of the case, really. So how does that kind of further complicate, or what else should we sort of be critical about or think critically about in the use of maps, given this particular place that they're in? They're not presented in like the evidence section of the trial.
No. And that's indeed, so the opening statement gives a bit of leeway for a more story-like story. And it's also hardly ever questioned. So what is said in the opening statement is not, it's not that the other party will interrupt to say, but hey, wait a minute, what's going on with this map? But in general, I think that maps are used quite uncritically. And then in this context of the opening statements, of course, if there's no discussion on what the map is representing, that's something to be aware of. And what is interesting, when I was sitting there looking at these maps also, at a public sitting in a public gallery, then you hear a discussion in the audience on the maps, and I heard even someone saying next to me, where did this person go to school? So people disagreed with the maps, but that's not something, of course, that you see when you're just watching the opening statement.
Fascinating. I think this is, I just love kind of how we're adding all these pieces in and going, hang on a second, let's unpick this. So another kind of aspect I want to unpick is how opening statements work in the broader sort of debate, tension, etc., between institutions like the ICC specifically and victims, right? That's already quite a big tension. And we sort of touched on it already, this anxiety about dealing with something that's very far away. Do you actually know enough to understand it, etc.? But opening statements you discuss in the book are kind of part of that debate. They set expectations and do things around what the different sides sort of say they're going to do or promise. Can you tell us about the opening statement in this sense?
Yeah, so I think especially the ICC is always presented as a victim-centered court, and victims are put forward as almost the raison d'être, the whole reason of existence of the ICC, also in light of a history of tribunals which have neglected maybe the voice of the victim. The ICC is promising to sort of remedy that. And if you look at the opening statement, there is a very interesting role assigned to victims in the truth-finding process. So victims are presented both as truth tellers, so those who know what actually happened, as well as truth seekers. And I think even there's a quote somewhere in the book of a victim representative who literally says, the victims now look up to the court to find the truth, or looking for answers about what happened. At the same time, they are the source of that. And I find that a very interesting tension, and also a very interesting how the truth is different things at the same time. And also how not every truth can be processed in a court of law, so it seems. So, for example, stories of the victims are sometimes more about the truth about the suffering. So not so much the truth about what happened, but the experiences of victims. The opening statement allows some room for those experiences to come to the fore without immediately being questioned in the way that you question facts. Like, did this really happen? Did you really suffer that much? You know, you are not going to ask that in an opening statement. But it's very uncomfortable because multiple reasons. But for example, the suffering is sometimes inexpressible. And in the court, it has to be put into words. And that does not necessarily match what it feels like. So there's a lot of literature on that as well. And also the idea that sometimes it's said just to the act of telling about the suffering is already some form of acknowledgement of the suffering of the victims. And that's maybe even enough. But at the same time, there is also the ICC presents itself, and especially in the opening statement, prosecutors present their task also to give clarification on the truth and to contextualize the truth of the victims. But the language of a trial is not well equipped to contextualize suffering. In that sense, it's a bit. Courts seem unable to deal with these kind of truths, with these truths about suffering. It's always mediated, always juridified. And there are these shifting roles between assigning a task to the court and to the victim in the truth-telling process. You see that shifting back and forth, and they both have a role, but in the end, it's all mediated through the language of the prosecutor.
Thank you for explaining that. I think the kind of idea of seeking truth but also being the source of information, that tension comes through really clearly. And again, it's kind of something we sort of know. Like, as soon as you say it, it's like, yeah, of course that makes sense. And then you're like, wait a second, that's going to cause some problems. So I quite liked that you make a point of saying in the book, like, I'm investigating and exploring these tensions. I'm not then going to tell you exactly what you need to do in every single instance to fix them.
No, and I also don't think that you can easily fix that. And I think maybe the point of the book even is to say, okay, if this is the format that we choose, if we choose the format of a trial, this is what we're going to get. We're going to get these tensions, and we're going to get these paradoxes. And if you don't want that, maybe we should do something else.
Yeah, I think that's really, really helpful. So switching then from kind of the analysis on the victim side, sort of how victims interact with this and are seen by the court in these statements, you have a section of the book where you investigate how opening statements think about, discuss, describe perpetrators. Which is quite often where a lot of the like really evocative language that, you know, becomes a media headline comes from. This is where a lot of the sort of inhuman and evil and all of that sort of goes. So I really appreciated that you do essentially a like statistical analysis of what words are used and kind of then discuss the impacts. So I was wondering if you could sort of tell us a little bit about how you did this analysis. Kind of what were you using and what were you looking for, and how did you sort of, what were the methods you used for this section?
Yeah, it's interesting that you say indeed that these are the things that make the headlines, and that's also what inspired me to have a bit more of a broader set a broader data set, because I was indeed wondering, okay, is this indeed, do we hear this because it's so dramatic and so appealing in a sensationalistic way that we hear that more than the rest, or is it really so frequently used? So I studied about 17 statements in different tribunals, the ICTUI, the ICC, the ECCC, Cambodia, and the Special Court of Sierra Leone. And I also selected different types of cases, so both high-profile cases as well as more mid-level or even low-level cases, to see if there was a difference between them as well. And you see that, well, of course, in all these narratives, the defendant is an important character, the most important character, even in victim-centered, so to speak, cases. Of course, it's an international criminal trial, so the defendant is the central figure. So that's how I studied it, and I did it a coding exercise, but a bottom-up one. So I read all these statements and I started to flag, so these are recurring terms and themes when they talk about the perpetrators or the defendants.
So then what were the terms that kept coming up? You split them into human and inhuman. What were kind of the top ones in each of those categories?
Yeah, so that was the first striking thing, of course. And then again, it's something that you're like, yeah, of course, I know that. But if you take a closer look, you're like, oh, this is how it works and doesn't work. Because indeed, a defendant has to be human and inhuman at the same time. It has to be a human being that can stand trial in a court of law, because it is indeed a human being, part of our community in a way. And at the same time, the violence and the scale of violence that we're talking about here, there must be some inhuman elements to this person, because otherwise it feels maybe not right to put this person in this international trial, etc. So human traits, I think most importantly, there is intelligence. So it's a smart person who manipulated people. And of course, it's a smart person because there has to be a plan, there was intent. I find it intriguing that at the same time people speak about mindless violence, etc. So there's again both a mind and a mindlessness to what is happening. Lust for power is absolutely one of the top things that that we see everywhere, and that includes terms like vanity, sadism, also aggressiveness. You see quite often, and that is described not as incidental behavior, but often there's sort of a picture of that it's a structural habit of these people to be violent. And on the inhuman side, there's of course a lot of comparison with animal behavior, not as much as maybe we would think when we just read the headlines. But beastly behavior, and also the other way around, that victims were treated like animals. So interestingly enough, the perpetrator is the animal and the victims were treated as animals at the same time. So those things, I think you see quite frequently. The word evil itself, I don't think that is very often used. It's more in by way of comparison between the good and the bad, for example, where again victims play an important role to make that contrast.
So this, I mean, again, as with literally every piece that we're discussing, there's tensions, and it sort of seems like it's doing one thing, and then you look at it and you're like, wait a second, that's kind of creating some problems, or like trying to do two things at the same time that are sort of contradictory. And I thought this one was really interesting because, as you said, like there's such a clear legal need for the defendant to be human and like mentally capable of standing trial. On the other hand, there also has to be, in some ways, kind of for legitimacy purposes, an argument made that like this crime is somehow worse than other crimes and that's why we're here, which is a really interesting tension. But then kind of, I want to sort of go to the other team here that we've mentioned a little bit, the defense teams. So we've already talked about the opening statement is not legally part of the case, so they can't really object or interact in the way that they can later on. On the other hand, like that's just allowing the prosecution to kind of sort of say whatever they want and really set the stage. We've talked about with maps, we've talked about with discussing victims, we've talked about with how perpetrators are described. So how do defense teams kind of respond to sitting there and listening to these statements?
Yeah, that's a good question, because also when you're studying the depictions of the defendants, it's really more than with the victims or the maps or the history. You get really curious, okay, but the defense cannot be silent on these characterizations, and they are not silent. And their responses are also really, really interesting and really beautiful even sometimes. So yes, I do think that a lot of defense teams flag the practice of dehumanization that is going on, and also flag that this is sensationalistic, that the whole depiction of the perpetrator is just for the stage. It's sensationalism. I like one defendant or defense team member at the ECCC who said, well, this opening statement sounded like a novel written by Alexandre Dumas. He was not entirely wrong, I don't think. but I this is a beautiful way of countering this, or at least of flagging, look, it's well said, it's a beautiful language, but we're talking about a human being here. And that's also then immediately the type of response they give. So the emphasizing that their client is human, and emphasizing the humanity of this person. And also not denying sometimes even that there is evil and that there are evil perpetrators, but it's not their client. And then they bring forward arguments like, my client is just a scapegoat. You need to have other guys. I mean, that happened, for example, in the Tadic case. Before the ICTY, or arguments like my client is a good Christian and he loves his community, and giving examples of that. So that is not that's not the defense of my client did not commit these acts, but it's really describing the personality of the client. And so I thought that was really intriguing how that's done. And also when you see, for example, when defendants actually plead guilty, they oftentimes talk about their own humanity and about their human regret, etc. So really showing the humanness, not the humaneness, but the humanness of the defendant is central in these defenses.
Interesting. That kind of makes it even more sort of that tension between the human and the inhuman even more intriguing in some ways. So I wanted to kind of ask about some of the implications of your work, not in terms of like what courts should and shouldn't do. We've sort of already discussed the challenges with that sort of thing. But kind of those of us interested in international law, international courts, particularly those, I'm guessing a number of our listeners are, people who study international law or international courts. And this is a really interesting book, as I said at the beginning, because it is obviously really heavily focused on international law and international courts, but a piece of them that's not technically part of law, that we don't necessarily teach about or learn about when we study law. And so kind of what should we as scholars, as those engaged in international criminal law, understand about opening statements and these sort of pieces on the edges of law in a way, or on the edges of cases, what should we sort of take forward with us?
Well, I think that in these ambiguous spaces, you can really start to see the more fundamental tensions that are in the very foundations of international criminal law. So I think the things that I flag happen in the opening statement and the paradoxes that we come across are not unique to the opening statement, but actually they display a lot about what we think international criminal law is, what we want it to be, and also how some of the things that are going on in these international criminal law projects are just fundamentally clashing, and that being victim-centered and giving a voice to victims, but not being able to actually stage that voice in your court is not a problem of the opening statement, but signals, of course, something much more fundamental about the incapability of trials to express suffering. Same goes for the perpetrators. This is not, it can never be a format to understand really what violence is about. That's also not the purpose of a trial, but I think it's good to realize that. And I think what it also brings us is a perspective on law as lawyers as storytellers, and an appreciation of that. I think it's not something that storytelling is not equaling something that it's not true or what, something like that, but really that law is a story telling field, but also that we should not take all these stories for granted, and that stories also have a purpose, and that the stories in the court of law simplify things. And what I like to do with this book and in general is to bring a bit of the complexities back, and to really peel down the way in which a chaotic reality is sanitized through language, and see what did we lose in that journey. What did we lose in the journey from what happened and not understanding to suddenly sort of pretending that we do understand and that we can all put this in this format that we call international criminal trials. So I think, yeah, that is what drives me, and I think that can also help you. I'm indeed not saying you should do it better or differently, but to realize what is happening when you tell such a story, and also what are the foundations of these paradoxes. I think it's always interesting to have a deeper look at that.
Yes, I certainly found it very interesting. Adding complexity, I think, is a good descriptor of what you've done, but very clearly, so that we understand what the paradoxes are, which is often difficult to do. So I wanted to ask about kind of a bit more about the process of the book. Obviously, you cover a number of different cases. Different parts of the book go into detail about different cases. You've already talked about the perpetrators, how you looked at 17 different opening statements. So obviously, that was a long process to go through all of it. I was wondering if there was anything, whether that was, you know, as you said, sitting in the public gallery or a document you came across or something, kind of let us behind the scenes a little bit into your process. Was there a moment or an item or something you came across that kind of surprised you?
Well, the whole project is driven by curiosity and surprise. I think also for me coming into this field, not being a lawyer made a difference. The first opening statement I saw was in a documentary, War Don Don, on the Special Court of Sierra Leone. And there the prosecutor, David Crane, made this very dramatic opening statement. And I think that is a familiar one for a lot of international criminal lawyers. And I was like, oh, wow, this is intense. And are all of these statements like that? And then it turned out that was not the case. And this was particularly dramatic. And also it got different responses. So in the legal community, it was really like, oh, this is not how you do it. This is not what an opening statement should be. And there were other voices saying, yeah, but this really fits with the oral tradition in Sierra Leone. So different thoughts on that. But indeed, it started me thinking like, oh, how does this work? And then I think all of the texts, the opening statements, if you want to know something about what the case is about, both like in a nutshell, what the case itself is about, but also what the tribunal is about, I think they're beautiful texts to read. Striking features are also, for example, the amount of mango trees in ICC statements, which sounds beautiful, but then also it gets you thinking about how again in this. In the back of my mind was, okay, you have this African bias discussion, and then suddenly there are all these mango trees. So what is that doing? And I think there's a lot in language and the way we phrase something, and it says a lot about our own background and baggages and the power of imagination. That is really, really striking. And what is also nice about the opening statements is that they're often recorded. So I had a chance to actually see a lot of them. I went to a couple of them in the ICC. And like you said, then that's a completely different experience when you're surrounded by an audience, which is always also a mixed audience of people like me, but also people who support one of the sides in the courtroom, a lot of interns who are sitting there aspiring to be a lawyer. It is a theater in many, many ways. Everything surprised me.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a good insight into the process. And obviously this book was a lot of work and over a lot of time, but it is now done. It is now officially out. People can read it. So what are you working on now or next?
So my current focus is, like I said in the beginning, I moved a bit more to the visualization of international law. And that I think started a bit with a chapter in this book on maps and landscape descriptions. And also when I noted how all of these visual presentations were becoming part of the procedures. So the role of photos and videos in the courtroom, but more and more also, and that still has to do with this interest in how international law more generally, so not only international criminal law, but how it is explained to the audience and also the different types of audiences. And the increasing use of visual means by international courts, so the International Criminal Court, they have a YouTube channel, they are very active on Twitter and Instagram. That's for a court of law. I don't know how it is elsewhere, but in the Netherlands, for example, that's not really a common practice. And also the type of content that they present on that visual content, again, is telling very specific stories about the role of international law in the world and how we should understand the world and how we understand conflict. And I think that in that sense, the themes I'm working with are still very similar, but now looking more at the visual aspects rather than the texts. But it's still language in a way.
Fascinating. Well, that sounds like a really interesting project. Hopefully, if that becomes a book, you can come back and tell us all about it.
I'd love to. Yes, of course.
Great. Well, while you are off doing that and scrolling through the ICC's Instagram channel.
Yeah, that's my job now. So.
Listeners can read your current book, which we've been discussing. Reminder, it's titled The Opening Statement of the Prosecution in International Criminal Trials, A Solemn Tale of Horror, published by Routledge in 2021. Dr. Sophia Stock, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.